The Celtic religions believed their goddess created this. Ancient Romans believed their goddess Minerva created it. For several thousand years, the Hindus have believed that their goddess Saraswati created it. The Greeks believed it came from Zeus. For generations, not only has mankind struggled with the idea of the origin of the human race, of course, for those who follow the scriptures, it's answered, but along with everything else, they struggled with what human beings are observably capable of doing, acting, thinking. In a word, wisdom. Where did wisdom come from? Where did the ability that is uniquely human to rationally consider the past and the present and the future, the ability to constructively create civilizations with justice and equity and grace and law, the ability to apply knowledge with insight to relational, ethical, financial, moral, spiritual issues. The Greeks believed that Zeus found out his wife was expecting. He wasn't too happy about it. In fact, he became so enraged he swallowed her whole. That's how you take care of it, I suppose. And then somehow she remained alive, and when it came time for her to deliver the baby girl, Zeus developed this intense headache and cured it by taking an axe and hitting himself in the head. This makes a lot of sense, I know, but stay with me. Anyway, through that opening in his head, out walked, fully grown, developed Athena. Athena would be the goddess of wisdom coming from the head of Zeus. Athens would be named in her honor. In fact, they would build the Parthenon in her honor. As most gods and goddesses of the pantheon of the Greek and Roman world, they would choose and be represented by an animal. Athena chose and was represented by the owl as her sacred bird. That gave rise to the popular belief that owls are wise birds. That superstition exists to this day. We talk about somebody being wiser than an owl. In fact, I did a little study as I did. It's all there. Wikipedia.com. I get paid for this. A group of owls is not referred to as a flock of owls, but as a parliament. And that word, of course, is used for that gathering of what we would hope to be wise parliamentarians. According to the Bible, that delivers to us the answer, wisdom comes from two sources. The word wisdom simply refers to applying the knowledge you have to your life, and it can be positive or negative. It can be holy or it can be unholy. Listen to what James says. He writes, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast. This is not the wisdom that comes from above, but this wisdom is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. And then he contrasts vile wisdom with another kind. He said, but the wisdom from above is pure, peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. I can't think of a better, more clearer, flesh and blood illustration that contrasts vile, demonic, earthy wisdom with pure, peaceable, holy, heavenly wisdom than 1 Samuel chapter 18. So if you have your Bibles, go back there and let's pick it up where we left off with the biography of the singer of Israel, David. Now in this particular chapter, you're going to actually follow David's rise and the demonstration of godly wisdom, and you're going to watch the digression of Saul and his demonstration of earthly wisdom. And what we're going to do as we go through the chapter is we're going to ask and answer the question, what does it mean to walk with wisdom? In fact, that word, wisdom, appears several times. It's never translated wisdom in my text, it may be in yours, it's translated successful or success. But it has to do with behaving wisely. And it's going to appear several times. In fact, as we go through this chapter rather quickly, we're going to answer the question by showing three defining characteristics of heavenly or pure wisdom. And let me define it by giving you the first of three now, and then eventually we'll get to the text. Walking wisely means, first of all, responding to promotion with humility. Now, let me set the stage. As you arrive at chapter 18, David has just gained instant popularity, hadn't he? He's killed the giant. He is, one author wrote, an overnight celebrity. He's the young giant killer, and his head must have been swimming. I mean, think about it. He left his father's little flock of sheep to take some cheese to his brothers, and 48 hours later, he's the giant killer. How's that for a change in life? It's like winning, you know, I thought about it. It's like probably a little like winning, you know, the American Idol, the X Factor, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I'm not sure if that's even on anymore, but you get the point. And Jeopardy, you know, all at the same time. In fact, if he were living today, he would be a guest on Duck Dynasty. He'd be wearing camo and he'd be teaching those guys how to use a slingshot, you know, to hunt. Truth is, everybody has David's name on their lips. He has launched into the stratospheric realm where he was a nobody and now he is somebody. He is somebody. He's a national hero. I agree with one author who wrote that very few people would be able to take all of this in stride. It would be easy to let all of this go to his head. But it didn't. All right, with that, let's begin at verse 1. As soon as David had finished speaking to Saul, answering his question about his family and clan, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. You might wonder, where was Jonathan when David went out to fight Goliath? We're not told, but from his reaction, it seems that Jonathan would have probably done it himself. Not willing or wanting to embarrass his father, he didn't do it. Look at verse 3. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. This is symbolic of a number of things, but first and foremost, you grab the fact that there's a deep friendship that just takes off as well. As David is being introduced to his father, Saul, this young man who, without any training in war, takes a slingshot and goes and marches against a giant and kills him, Jonathan is effectively saying, this is my kind of guy. This guy's soul is my soul. This guy's heart is my heart. His character. It's my desire to honor the God of Israel. And by the way, the foundation for any friendship, any deep friendship, is not compatibility or chemistry. It is shared character. It's shared vision. It's shared faith and trust in the living God. That's why you might not know much about the people that sit around you, but there is a kinship because you share Christ and this common life. You get on a plane and you're sitting next to somebody and you find out they're a believer and immediately there's kinship. This is the foundation of their friendship, certainly faith in the living God. And by the way, I do need to address this just for a moment. There are those who would shamefully twist this text into something sexual, homosexual. Because we're told that Jonathan loved David. For those who would hold that view, all they need to do is read the rest of the Bible, the rest of this chapter, even in English. The same word for love is going to show up four times in this text, all from the same Hebrew verb. In fact, in verse 16, we're told that all Israel and Judah loved David. There's nothing sexual in that verb. In verse 20 and also 28, we're told that Michal, the daughter of Saul, loved David, and that's before they consummated their marriage. Back in verse 22, the verb shows up again where we read that all the servants of the king loved David. I mean, the point is obvious, isn't it? Everybody loved David. Furthermore, this particular Hebrew verb for love, and there are several, this one has political overtones to it. It's interesting to discover this in my research. You can use the word to talk about conspiring together in some alliance. And that's the idea. You need to understand that when Jonathan took off his robe and gave it to David, when the servants of Saul and the daughter of Saul loved David, they are effectively transferring, even in a sense prophetically or presciently, their loyalty to this one who we know is the heir apparent. Later on in chapter 20, Saul is going to condemn Jonathan for as much as handing the kingdom over to David. He's going to say, Jonathan, you're out of your mind because of his love. It has political overtones to it. In fact, what we really ought to be doing is we ought to be sort of amazed at Jonathan, his humility. If anybody ought to be given a cold shoulder to David, it's Jonathan. If anybody ought to be threatened with somebody else that might take the throne, it would be Jonathan. And yet he isn't in any way intimidated. He loves the heart of David in his faith. I have an old book in my library, well out of print, by a Puritan author by the name of Blakey, who commented on this moment when these two young men are introduced. And he says this: no shadow of jealousy darkens Jonathan's brow. Self-seekers and self-pleasers look at him and be ashamed. Never were hands more cordially grasped. Never were congratulations more warmly shared. Verse 5. David went out, and here it is again, and was successful wherever Saul sent him. That is, from this Hebrew verb, sachal, it's often translated, in fact, in the Old Testament, wisdom or wise. It simply is saying this. Samuel is telling us that David walked wisely. Success, I think, is an unfortunate translation because success has nothing to do with money or promotion or prestige or family or connections. It has to do with walking with wisdom. And that's what David was doing. In fact, the same word will show up again in verse 14. David behaved wisely, you can render it, in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. So what does Saul do with a wise, prudent young man who has exercised such faith in the living God? I know what you do. You promote that kind of guy. And so David, verse 5, tells us, is promoted by Saul. He is set over the men of war. It's amazing to me. Now, David hadn't had any practice swinging a sword, but now he's the general. He would be certainly second in command to Abner. He just kind of soars to the top of the heap, and everybody is okay with that. Even all the soldiers, as we see. And nowhere in this chapter do you find David admiring his own reflection. Nowhere in these early days does he send a message home to his brothers, especially Eliab. You remember Eliab who told David when he came out with the cheese, what are you doing out here? You just want to be a hotshot. Go back to those few sheep. I mean, can't you see David sending a postcard from the palace back to Eliab? And one message, nah, 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 whatever that is in Hebrew. Look at me now. Your little brother. None of that. Listen, walking wisely means you are able to discern what moment is the perfect time to keep your mouth shut. The problem is everybody else is talking. Look at verse 6. As they're coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. They're coming back Could even be a later campaign. The Philistine could be a general usage of one more campaign against the Philistine. We don't know. But this is common in ancient times. Victory celebrations normally led by the women who meet the returning troops with dancing, singing. The singing, the Hebrew text informs us it's antiphonal. That is, a group of women would chant one thing or sing one thing and another group would sing back to them. We'll see how the lyrics are shared between them in just a minute. But according to historians, you also need to understand that when it says they're out there dancing, they're not doing some random shuffle. This isn't some unrehearsed two-step, you know, the disco twirl or whatever. This is actually very well organized. In fact, you need to think in your minds of a parade. And they're dancing the war dance, the victory war dance of Israel. Details which have not survived the centuries. We're only told they're doing it. But typical of every culture, there are symbolic, culturally rich songs and dances that kind of embody the heart and the soul of that nation. In our Western world, we've dropped the choreographed dance and we have the national anthem. And that alone stirs our hearts whenever we hear it sung. Where we sing along. By the way, as a side note, and I got to be really quick about this, this was the issue in Judges chapter 16 where the Philistines had captured Samson, put out his eyes. He had given away his secret to Delilah. They had him now captured. The King James translates it that they brought him out when they were celebrating this banquet in this temple supported by these columns. And the ESV says they brought him out to entertain them. King James translates it to make sport. It's the same verb found here in 1 Samuel 18. What they did effectively was they brought Samson out into the courtyard near supporting pillars and then made him, to mock him, dance the victory dance of Israel and to sing the national anthem of this nation that had been defeated and, more importantly, the God that had been defeated. So they make this man dance and sing their victory dance and song. And they kind of revel in the fact that he's been and his nation and his God defeated. And they laugh and they jeer until Samson, of course, brings the house down. God is not vindicating Samson's sinful stupidity. God is effectively judging the Philistines' utter blasphemy. Now back to Samuel, you have this victory parade, the victory dance and the chant, and it's going back and forth. And they have some lyrics that they've added. And these are the lyrics given to us. Here's what they're singing. Verse 7. One group of women would be singing the first line, the second group the next. Saul has struck down his thousands. David his 10,000s. And they go back and forth. Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. Talk about raining on Saul's parade. That did it. Verse 8. And Saul was very angry. And this saying, these lyrics, displeased him. And he said to himself, by the way, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands, and what more can he have? Here's the issue. But the kingdom. And Saul eyed David from that day on. Now, whether or not David picked up on the suspicion of Saul, we're not told, and I would doubt it because of the way the chapter bears out, at least until near the end of the chapter. But what we do know from this chapter is that David isn't saying anything. He's not poking Saul in the eye. He's not going around the palace humming the new lyrics to this song. I love that new chorus. Let me sing it for you. You know, none of that. Behaving wisely means responding to promotion with humility. Secondly, behaving wisely means tolerating the weaknesses of others with grace. Let me show you what I mean. Verse 10. The next day, an evil or harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre as he did day by day or whenever he was called upon. Let's stop for a moment because this needs a better understanding. God isn't doing evil. He doesn't. Or does he tempt evil? He's not worked out a deal with some demon. The word spirit, it might help you to write on the margin of your Bible, can be translated breath. Breath. This is the breath of God. Now the question is, it says evil or harmful. I think that's a better translation. It could be translated unpleasant. You could actually translate it as well, miserable. In fact, the words rushed upon Saul or fell upon Saul is from a word that means to literally overwhelm. He's overwhelmed by this miserable breath from God. What does that sound like? Sounds like conviction to me. It's exactly what it is. In fact, Job will use the same verb to talk about his despair, and it'll be translated terrified. What's happening to Saul is a deep, despairing, terrifying, miserable, depressing conviction over his sin. Not to mention the crumbling of his self-made plans and his self-made kingdom and his self-made throne and the promise of Samuel, where he's been told it won't be your dynasty. Your throne is going to go to your neighbor. Just didn't name him. Now he's contending with the rise of this young man who may very well be the man to take his place. And did you notice we're told this takes place the day after the parade? With this new song ringing in his ears. Tearing away at his pride, the convicting work of God in his heart because he refuses to repent. It's eating him alive. That's what's happening. So what do you do when you try to silence a guilty conscience? What do you do when you refuse to repent? I'll tell you what you don't do. You don't get along where it's quiet. You turn up the music. You get distracted. You don't want to drive to work in silence. You don't want to think. Because the moment it's quiet around you, it becomes even more miserable. So find something to distract you, to forget, to help you forget. And just about anything will do. I'll never forget hearing Howard Hendricks in class talk about his neighbor who owned a boat. He spent every spare minute on that boat. He would spend his day off waxing and waxing and waxing and polishing his boat. And then he would come over to Hendricks. He came over to him one time and he said, "I've got 37 coats of wax on my boat." Hendricks would look at us and say, "You know, I never disparaged him. In fact, I didn't even say anything negative to him. Because I knew that my neighbor's boat was his only form of anesthesia to deaden the pain of an empty life. Had to find something to distract me. Might not be bad in and of itself. Nothing wrong with a boat. If you feel convicted, want to give it to me, great. See me after the service, all right? That's not the point. The point is, we got to do something with our hands. We got to turn up the music. We got to get distracted. We got to be entertained. We got to do something because we cannot be quiet under the breath of a convicting God. So where is that musician? Only now he recognizes him. Verse 10. While he's raving in his house, David's playing the lyre. It's a small hand-held harp, the forerunner of a guitar. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." David evaded him. This is the most shocking word of all. Twice. Twice. In other words, David didn't dodge one spear, but two. More than likely, this phrase summarizes the fact that Saul threw at two different occasions, two different times, a spear at David, or it could mean that he missed the first time and grabbed another spear. I mean, you duck once, how do you come back? Later, Saul will throw a spear at his own son, Jonathan. See, here's the downward digression of a man who's eaten alive with envy. I think it's well said by Francis Bacon that envy is the worst of all passions because it never gives you a holiday. It begins with hurt. You're hurt, which leads to hate, which leads to hostility, which can lead to harm. Hurt, hate, hostility, and harm. But again, no word from David, no angry retaliation. David doesn't whistle that lyre back at Saul's head. I don't know what he does. Ducks. And by the way, what do you do when somebody throws a spear at you? Duck. And then second of all, and more importantly, don't pick it up and throw it back. Because when you do, you lose. You join them in that digression. There are plenty of people out there that are skilled at spear throwing. Don't learn that art. Don't join them in that downward spiral. It will never give you a day off. Don't rush to the wrong interpretation here. I think David is unaware of Saul's true intention. And I think the chapter bears it out, which is why I principalized the second observation in the way I did. Evidently in the minds of the people in the court and in David's own mind, this spear throwing is categorized as, well, Saul's raving again. We don't know what brings it on, but maybe it's a dark mood, or maybe it's the pressure, or maybe he can't help it. He doesn't really mean anything by it. In fact, one author said that everyone at this point in time would have believed that King Saul was dangerous, but not malicious. Again, we're the ones that are let in on the inside scoop. We know what's happening. They don't. I just think that Saul is overwhelmed by something he can't control. He's overwhelmed by some dangerous, some difficult, some depressing episode. What this means then, especially for David to get back on that little stool within spear reach, is that David is making allowances for Saul as well. Even though he's the one used for target practice. David, I think if he were a part of our assembly, or if he were in your family, or where you work, he would probably be the kind of person who is insulted. And then he says, they really didn't mean it. You know, there's something else going on. I'm sure they didn't intend that. Don't you just love those people? Giving the benefit of the doubt, which, by the way, is an evidence of true love. Maybe they're bothered by other things. This is exactly the grace of Jesus Christ, the coming Son of David. And it still blows my mind that on the cross, he would effectively say, Father, forgive them. They really don't fully understand what they're doing. Are you kidding? You're on a cross. This is not naivety. I think this is willingness to offer someone the benefit of the doubt. This is the oil of relationships. This is what salves relationships. This is the salve of grace. The truth is, we want people to give us the benefit of the doubt, don't we? That's why we'll do something rather horrid or mean or unkind, and we'll say, you know, I'm just having a bad what? A bad day. In other words, void all of that. Contextualize all of that because I'm having a tough day. We want people to give us the benefit of that kind of doubt. Can you imagine, David? Here's a spear. Phew. I know you're just having a bad day. And I'm really glad you're a bad shot. When you do this, you are walking in wisdom. Behaving wisely means responding to promotion with humility. It means tolerating the weaknesses of others with grace. David didn't know what was going on. He won't for a while. There's one more characteristic I want to point out. Behaving wisely means surrendering to the providence of God without complaint. Now, so far, this rise of David has been a kind of a Cinderella story, hasn't it been? Apart from, you know, the crazy king who every once in a while throws spears, this has been an amazing life. David is now in the palace. His closest friend is the king's son. He's been promised the king's daughter. He's traded in his tattered tunic for royal clothing. He's training in the art of battle. He's been promoted. And everyone loves him. But in the remainder of this chapter, which I'm going to fly over, David is going to encounter some setbacks which we could easily miss. I want to point them out. Two of them. First of all, he's demoted. Now, find verse 5 and then look over at verse 13. I want you to notice the subtle difference. In verse 5, David is placed over all the men of war, no doubt under the trained and experienced eye of General Abner, but effectively in command of the entire army. Now look at verse 13. Saul removes him from his presence, his immediate presence, and makes him a commander of 1,000. In other words, David loses his seat with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And now he's given a single regiment of men. This is a demotion that's obvious. It would have made people wonder and talk. Second of all, he's not only demoted, he's denied. Now there is some space of time in this chapter as we allow for several campaigns to take place. David's coming and going. This is military terminology for leading campaigns. Saul is delaying his prize. You remember one of them? To give his daughter to the man who defeats Goliath. That hasn't happened. Saul has 2 daughters. That hasn't happened. Verse 14 informs us that David is walking wisely in all his undertakings. Everybody sees, observes, the Lord is with him. Next verse 15, when Saul saw that he had great success, that as he was walking with wisdom, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. Saul is thinking to himself, I'm just going to wait. Maybe one of those campaigns, he'll get it by an arrow or something, but David just won't die. David, in his humility, is saying to the king and others, he really doesn't deserve to be a son-in-law. As this delay continues on, he's giving the king again the benefit of the doubt. Now, this is verse 19. But at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, instead. David's demotion, and now the denial of the king's daughter, is spelling trouble. Trial. Everybody loved David, but now it's clear that not everybody loved David. David, again, purposefully resists any urge to get even, to strike back, to demand his due, to defend his honor. In fact, I think by now David could have probably mounted a successful coup. The army's behind him. They love him. He's successful in every campaign. The household servants, that would also include the officials of the king's palace, love him. Saul is a raving, mad lunatic. He's lost a tremendous amount of credibility. He lost it by not fighting Goliath, by actually allowing an unarmed shepherd, effectively, to go after Goliath. Unable to claim any of that prize. He's lost his reputation among the palace elite by his spear-throwing episodes. Everybody's just kind of on eggs now. Everybody knows that God is with David, and Saul knows that too. And then, about the time I think Saul wonders if David is just going to fade away and be yesterday's news, look what happens in verse 20. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased them. What? They told Saul that his daughter loved David, and it pleased him. No dad is happy to find out that his daughter loves anybody, right? You mean to tell me my youngest daughter loves this man, this young man? Why? You don't have to wonder why it pleased him, because in verse 22 we're told Saul commanded his servants, look, without telling them or him that I've sent you, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delight in you. I mean, never mind the spear holes in the wall. The king actually really delights in you. And all the servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law. David says, oh, that'd be great, but how? I'm a poor man. Which, by the way, tells us that the king has also lied about fulfilling another one of his promises to give wealth to the champion over Goliath. I can't pay the mohar, the bridal dowry, if he demands it of me. Oh, that's not going to be a problem, David. You can do what Caleb did of old. The king is hearkening back to his Old Testament. He's thinking about Caleb, and he's going to allow you to become the champion, and you'll get the daughter. Well, what do I have to do to be the champion? Go kill 100 Philistines, cut off their foreskins, and bring them to the king, and that'll be payment enough. Talk about crass and rude and gross and bloody. Yet it was a common practice that Saul is practicing here. In fact, we have discovered on the walls of the temples of Ramses III scenes drawn depicting the counting of hands to prove the death of enemies and a pile of foreskins collected for the same purpose. See, David, what you got to do is go out and kill 100 Gentiles, and you got to be able to prove they weren't unsuspecting Israelites. You're going to be able to prove that one way, this way. Bring them in, and Saul will give you his daughter. Now, Saul assumes that David won't live through this campaign. I mean, every Philistine is going to rally to this charge. Verse 27 tells us he not only did that, but here's another 100 for good measure. I think David is wise to the king now. He knows how the king gets out of his promises, and the text implies a public display and counting. David publicly lays out his scouts, so to speak, and the king is entirely boxed in. He's stripped of all his excuses. He is publicly, to his servants, promised his daughter, and now he has to give his daughter to the man he dreads more than anybody else on the planet. He has no recourse now. Verse 29, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Don't miss that last line. It isn't the throwaway, none of it is. It's easy to downplay the implications. Saul was David's enemy continually. The Cinderella story is going to change very quickly, because Saul isn't going to stop until one of them is dead. In one of his books, Lloyd John Ogilvie retells of an Olympic race in early Grecian history, where one young athlete came in second place, and it so disturbed him, upset him, devastated him. He trained long and hard. He believed he was better than the young man who won the gold medal. His memory was haunted by that day of things he might have done differently, the race he should have won, the crowd that chanted and cheered the name of the victor. They both had come from the same town, and when they returned home, the city fathers agreed to commission a statue carved out of granite, made in the likeness of this gold medalist. It was completed. It was positioned on a towering base so that the city's most revered athlete stood some 20 feet high in the center of the town square. And it was more than this defeated athlete could take. Corrosive envy ate away at him. Couldn't bear the daily reminder of his failure. So he decided to destroy that statue. And he developed a plan that took shape in his mind. Late each night, when the city square was empty, he would sneak out to that towering statue with a chisel and a hammer, and he would, as quietly as he could, chisel away at the base of that statue, hoping to weaken the foundation so that maybe in some blustery rainstorm or some driving windstorm, it would topple over and break into a dozen pieces. One night, as he chiseled away with a little too much energy and anger and envy, he went too hard. And that heavy statue toppled over, and the villagers found him the next morning crushed beneath the statue of the one he had grown to hate. Among others, the moral of that legend lies in the fact that that young man in reality had been dying long before. One stroke at a time. In about 13 years, Saul will be dead. The truth is, he's already started dying. By the end of this chapter, Saul should have been happier than ever. He's got a commander that just wins one victory after another. His kingdom is more settled and secure than ever. His daughter has found the man she loves, and that brings happiness to their home. And David should be the one eaten up with envy over what Saul didn't give him. He should be the one eaten alive with resentment and bitterness. I mean, there are spear holes in the wall. And I've never treated him unkindly. Verse 30, though, ends with the same phrase that began this chapter, that David had more success. There's that word again. David walked more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed, certainly among the people. Walking in wisdom is responding to promotion with humility. It is tolerating the weaknesses of others with grace. It is surrendering to the providence of God without complaint.